post. Three archbishops of Canterbury during the 18th century were the sons of small tradesmen. There was, in fact, much less snobbery and money worship during the century when the British Empire was being won than during the century when it is being talked about. Samuel Wesley was allowed to remain at Oxford, where he supported himself by devices known to his tribe, and when he left the university to be ordained, he had clear in his pouch, after discharging his few debts, 10 farthings, 15 shillings. He had thus made 8 farthings, 9 shillings, out of his university, and had his education, as it were, thrown in for nothing. He soon obtained a curacy in London, and married a daughter of the well-known ejected clergyman, Dr. Annesley, about whom you may read in another 18th century book, The Life and Errors of John Dunton. Wesley's mother. The mother of the Wesleys was a remarkable woman, though cast in a mold not much to our minds nowadays. She had 19 children and greatly prided herself on having taught them, one after another, by frequent chastisements to, what do you think, to cry softly. She had theories of education and strength of will and of arm, too, to carry them out. She knew Latin and Greek, and though a stern, forbidding, almost an unfeeling parent, she was successful in winning and retaining not only the respect, but the affection of such of her huge family as lived to grow up. But out of the 19, 13 early succumbed. Infant mortality was one of the great facts of the 18th century, whose Rachels had to learn to cry softly over their dead babes. The mother of the Wesleys thought more of her children's souls than of their bodies. A domestic squall. The revolution of 1688 threatened to disturb the early married life of Samuel Wesley and his spouse. The husband wrote a pamphlet in which he defended revolution principles, but the wife secretly adhered to the old cause. Nor was it until a year before Dutch William's death that the rector made the discovery that the wife of his bosom, who had sworn to obey him and regard him as her overlord, was not in the habit of saying amen to his fervent prayers on behalf of his suffering sovereign. An exclamation was demanded and the truth extracted, namely, that in the opinion of the rector's wife, her true king lived over the water. The rector at once refused to live with Mrs. Wesley any longer until she recanted. This she refused to do, and for a 12-month the couple dwelt apart. When William III, having the good sense to die, a reconciliation became possible. If John Wesley was occasionally a little pig-headed, need one wonder. The story of the fire at Epworth Rectory and the miraculous escape of the infant John was once a tale as well known as Alfred in the Neat Herd's Hut, and pictures of it still hang up in many a collier's home. John Wesley received a sound classical education at Charterhouse and Christ Church, and remained all his life very much the scholar and the gentleman. No company was too good for John Wesley, and nobody knew better than he did that had he cared to carry his powerful intelligence, his flawless constitution, and his infinite capacity for taking pains into any of the markets of the world, he must have earned for himself place, fame, and fortune. Coming, however, as he did, of a theological stock, having a saint for a father and a notable, devout woman for a mother, Wesley from his early days learned to regard religion as the business of his life, just as the young Pitt came to regard the House of Commons as the future theater of his actions. My Jack is Fellow of Lincoln. After a good deal of heart-searching and theological talk with his mother, Wesley was ordained a deacon by the excellent Potter, afterward primate, but then, 1725, Bishop of Oxford. In the following year, Wesley was elected a Fellow of Lincoln, to the great delight of his father. "Whatever I am," said the good old man, "my Jack is Fellow of Lincoln." Wesley's motive never eludes us. In his early manhood, after being greatly affected by Jeremy Taylor's holy living and dying, in the Imitatio Christi, and by Law's serious call and Christian perfection, he met a serious man who said to him, "Sir, you wish to serve God and go to heaven? Remember, you cannot serve him alone. You must therefore find companions or make them. The Bible knows nothing of solitary religion." He was very confident, this serious man, and Wesley never forgot his message. You must find companions or make them. The Bible knows nothing of solitary religion. These words forever sounded in Wesley's ears, determining his theology, which rejected the stern individualism of Calvin, and fashioning his whole polity, his famous class meetings, and generally gregarious methods. Therefore to him it was given, many to save with himself. We may continue the quotation and apply to Wesley the words of Mr. Arnold's memorial to his father. Languor was not in his heart, weakness not in his word, weariness not on his brow. If you ask what is the impression left upon the reader of the journal as to the condition of England question, the answer will vary very much with the tenderness of the reader's conscience and with the extent of his acquaintance with the general behavior of mankind at all times and in all places. No sentimentalist. Wesley himself is no alarmist, no sentimentalist. He never gushes, seldom exaggerates, and always writes on an easy level. Naturally enough, he clings to the supernatural and always disposed to believe in the bona fides of ghosts and the diabolical origin of strange noises. But outside this realm of speculation, Wesley describes things as he saw them. In the first published words of his friend Dr. Johnson, he meets with no basilisks that destroy with their eyes. His crocodiles devour their prey without tears, and his cataracts fall from the rocks without deafening the neighboring inhabitants. Wesley's humor is of the species Donish, and his modes and methods quietly persistent. Wesley's humor. On Thursday, May 20th, 1742, I set out. The next afternoon, I stopped a little at Newport Pagnell and then rode on till I overtook a serious man with whom I immediately fell into conversation. He presently gave me to know what his opinions were. Therefore, I said nothing to contradict them. But that did not content him. He was quite uneasy to know whether I held the doctrines of the decrees as he did. But I told him over and over we had better keep to practical things lest we should be angry at one another. And so we did for 2 miles till he caught me unawares and dragged me into the dispute before I knew where I was. He then grew warmer and warmer, told me I was rotten at heart and supposed I was one of John Wesley's followers. No, I told him, I am John Wesley himself. Upon which, in Latin, I'm sorry, which I don't know, improvisum esprit voluti que sentibus ancium precept. He would gladly have run away outright. But being the better mounted of the two, I kept close to his side and endeavored to show him his heart till we came into the street of Northampton. What a picture have we here of a fine May morning in 1742. The unhappy Calvinist trying to shake off the Armenian Wesley. But he cannot do it. John Wesley is the better mounted of the two, and so they scamper together into Northampton. The England described in the journal is an England still full of theology. All kinds of queer folks abound. Strange subjects are discussed in odd places. There was drunkenness and cockfighting, no doubt, but there were also deists, mystics, Swedenborgians, Antiomians, Necessitarians, Anabaptists, Quakers, nascent heresies, and slow-dying delusions. Villages were divided into rival groups, which fiercely argued the nicest points in the aptest language. Nowadays, in one's rambles, a man is as likely to encounter a gray badger as a black Calvinist. England in Wesley's day. The clergy of the established church were jealous of Wesley's interference in their parishes, nor was this unnatural. He was not a nonconformist, but a brother churchman. What right had he to be so peripatetic? But Wesley seldom records any instance of gross clerical misconduct. Of one drunken parson he does indeed tell us, and he speaks disapprovingly of another whom he found one very hot day consuming a pot of beer in a lone alehouse. When Wesley, with that dauntless courage of his, a courage which never forsook him, which he wore on every occasion with the delightful ease of a soldier, pushed his way into fierce districts amid rough miners dwelling their own village communities almost outside the law, what most strikes one with admiration, not less in Wesley's journal than in George Fox's, a kindred though earlier volume, is the essential fitness for freedom of our rudest populations. They were coarse and brutal and savage, but rarely did they fail to recognize the high character and lofty motives of the dignified mortal who had traveled so far to speak to them. The mobs he met. Wesley was occasionally hustled and once or twice pelted with mud and stones, but at no time were his sufferings at the hand of the mob to be compared with the indignities it was long the fashion to heap upon the heads of parliamentary candidates. The mob knew and appreciated the difference between a Bub Doddington and a John Wesley. I do not think any ordinary Englishman will be much horrified at the demeanor of the populace. If there was a disturbance, it was usually quelled. At Norwich, two soldiers who disturbed a congregation were seized and carried before their commanding officer, who ordered them to be soundly whipped. In Wesley's opinion, they richly deserved all they got. He was no sentimentalist, although an enthusiast. Where the reader of the journal will be shocked is when his attention is called to the public side of the country, to the state of the jails, to Newgate, to Bethlehem, to the criminal code, to the brutality of so many of the judges and the harshness of the magistrates, to the supineness of the bishops, to the extinction in high places of the missionary spirit, in short, to the heavy slumber of humanity. Wesley was full of compassion, of a compassion wholly free from hysterics and like exaltative. In public affairs, his was the composed zeal of a Howard. His efforts to penetrate the dark places were long in vain. He says in his dry way, "They won't let me go to Bedlam, because they say I make the inmates mad, or into Newgate, because I make them wicked." The reader of the journal will be at no loss to see what these sapient magistrates meant. Wesley was a terribly exciting preacher, quiet though his manner was. He pushed matters home without flinching. He made people cry out and fall down, nor did it surprise him that they should. Ever a preacher. If you want to get into the last century, to feel its pulses throb beneath your finger, be content sometimes to leave the letters of Horace Walpole unturned. Resist the drowsy temptation to waste your time over the learned triflers who sleep in the 17 volumes of Nichols. Nay, even deny yourself your annual reading of Boswell or your biennial retreat with Sterne, and ride up and down the country with the greatest force of the 18th century in England. No man lived nearer the center than John Wesley, neither Clive nor Pitt, neither Mansfield nor Johnson. You cannot cut him out of our national life. No single figure influenced so many minds, no single voice touched so many hearts. No other man did such a life's work for England. As a writer, he has not achieved distinction. He was no Athanasius, no Augustine. He was ever a preacher and an organizer, a laborer in the service of humanity. But happily for us, his journals remain, and from them we can learn better than from anywhere else what manner of man he was and the character of the times during which he lived and moved and had his being. Augustine Birrell. biographical sketch. So fine an old man I never saw. The happiness of his mind beamed forth in his countenance. Every look showed how fully he enjoyed the gay remembrance of a life well spent. Alexander Knox of John Wesley. Like the others of the Epworth family, John Wesley was small in stature, barely 5'6" and weighing only 122 pounds. He was yet muscular and strong. Bright hazel eyes, fine features, an aquiline nose, a fine forehead, and a clear complexion combined to make his face arresting. Contemporaries have said that his eyes retained their bright and penetrating quality even to his last years. Meticulous as to personal appearance and habits, he never appeared other than neatly dressed, narrow plaited stock, coat with a small upright collar, and three-cornered hat. "I dare no more write in a fine style," said he, "than wear a fine coat." "Exactly so," remarked Canon Overton, but then he was particular about his coats. He was most careful never to be slovenly in his dress, always to be dressed in good taste. It is just the same with his style. It is never slovenly, never tawdry. Henry Moore, who lived with Wesley in his latter years, says that he never saw a misplaced book or a scrap of paper lying about in Wesley's study. His exactness and punctuality made it possible for him to carry the tremendous burden of work that fell to his lot, and to do it with perfect poise. He carefully weighed the value of his time and was never hurried in mind or manner. He had no time to mend anything that he either wrote or did. He therefore always did everything not only with quietness, but with what might be thought slowness. Henry Moore. Himself a delightful companion, Wesley disliked having people around who were in a bad humor, and if he did find himself in such company, he did his utmost to soothe ruffled tempers. Wherever Wesley went, he diffused a portion of his own felicity. Easy and affable in his demeanor, he accommodated himself to every sort of company and showed how happily the most finished courtesy may be blended with the most perfect piety. In his conversation, we might be at a loss whether to admire most his fine classical taste, his extensive knowledge of men and things, or his overflowing goodness of heart. While the grave and serious were charmed with his wisdom, his sportive sallies of innocent mirth delighted even the young and thoughtless, and both saw in his uninterrupted cheerfulness the excellency of true religion. No cynical remarks on the levity of youth embittered his discourses. No applause of retrospect to past times marked his present discontent. In him, even old age appeared delightful, like an evening without a cloud, and it was impossible to observe him without wishing fervently, "May my latter end be like his." Knox. Once when Wesley and one of his itinerant preachers were taking lunch at a wealthy home, an incident occurred which showed the great man's tact. The daughter of the house, a beautiful girl, was much impressed with Mr. Wesley's preaching. While conversing with the young lady, Wesley's itinerant noticed that she was wearing a number of rings. Holding her hand up for Mr. Wesley to see, he said, "What do you think of this, sir, for a Methodist hand?" Wesley's aversion for the wearing of jewelry was well known. The girl blushed and no doubt felt ill at ease. But with characteristic poise, Wesley only smiled and said, "The hand is very beautiful." The young lady appeared at the next service without her gems and became a devoted Christian. Robert Southey, one of Wesley's biographers, gives us a glimpse of his love for children. "I was in a house in Bristol where Wesley was, when a mere child on running down